The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It is unconstitutional, the plaintiffs argue, for the federal government to, you know, try to persuade platforms to take down constitutionally protected speech. And you know, that's why a lot of the questions at argument yesterday were focused on all of the circumstances in which the government historically and up to the present day does that routinely as a matter of course. And, you know, a lot of justices were trying to grapple with what the implications of the plaintiff's very broad legal theory, you know, would be. But if they accept that legal theory, then the plaintiffs probably have a strong case. You know, but to accept that legal theory would be to essentially undo 60 years of legal precedent in the lower court focusing on the line between persuasion and coercion.
I'm Quinta Jurasik, a senior editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 21st, 2024. Today we're bringing you an episode of Arbiters of Truth, our series on the information ecosystem. On March 18th, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Murthy v. Missouri, concerning the potential First Amendment implications of government outreach to social media platforms, what's sometimes known as jawboning. The case arrived at the Supreme Court with a somewhat shaky evidentiary record, but the legal questions raised by government requests or demands to remove online content are real. To make sense of it all, Matt Peralta and I called up Alex Abdo, the litigation director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. While the law in this area is unsettled, the Supreme Court seems skeptical of the plaintiff's claims of government censorship. But what's the best way to determine what contacts and government requests are and aren't permissible? It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 21st. Jawboning at the Supreme Court. It's been a long and winding road to get here. So to start off, can you just give us an overview of what exactly this case is and how on earth we ended up here?
Yeah, the case is about whether both the Biden and Trump administrations violated the First Amendment by pressuring the major social media platforms to take down what the administrations claimed was disinformation. You know, the cases were filed by a couple of states and a couple of individual plaintiffs arguing that their posts relating to COVID-19 and the vaccines and the 2020 elections had been, in their words, censored by Facebook and Twitter at the behest of the government. And so the question that came before the Supreme Court was whether the plaintiffs had, you know, raised plausible constitutional claims under the First Amendment that the administrations had coerced the platforms into doing its dirty work for them.
Before we get more into the details, I do want to make sure we touch on the procedural posture of the case, because that's sort of part of the complication here. So we ended up first, there was this case before Judge Terry Dowdy, a district judge, who issued an extremely broad injunction. Then it went up to the Fifth Circuit, which narrowed it somewhat, but it was still pretty broad. And then all that was stayed while this was before the Supreme Court. Can you just talk a little bit about that kind of procedural route that it took and the scope of the injunction? Because I do think that strangeness in the underlying courts, which I do want to make sure we talk about a little bit more, is sort of important to understanding some of the subtext of the arguments.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, the case went up on a preliminary injunction issued by the district court, like you said, and the district court took in a voluminous record submitted by the parties and made findings of fact as the basis for the preliminary injunction that it entered. It issued this extremely broad preliminary injunction that essentially forbade the federal government from interacting with the social media platforms in a variety of ways, including a lot of ways that would have been perfectly constitutional for the federal government to do. And it even reached private researchers who wanted to engage with the government about their research in ways where the researchers were welcoming the interactions. The Fifth Circuit broadly endorsed the findings of the district court in most respects, not in all, but then significantly narrowed the scope of the injunction in an effort to, make sure it didn't reach a lot of perfectly permissible interactions between the government and the social media platforms and the government and researchers. It still reached, I think, quite a bit more broadly than the First Amendment actually requires the government to, than the First Amendment line that limits government interactions with the platforms. But that's what went up to the Supreme Court. And the reason why that's relevant is because the preliminary injunction was based on findings of fact by the district court. And usually findings of fact are reviewed very deferentially by appellate courts, including the Supreme Court. That question came up at argument yesterday in a couple, different cases where various justices were basically asking, how much deference do we owe the district court's findings of fact? And, by the way, a lot of people have pointed out, Mike Masnick did a great, run through of all the factual finding or a lot of the factual findings by the district court. Some of the amicus briefs submitted did this, pointing out that the district court just got a lot of things wrong, which was very strange and suggested that there was motivated reasoning going on. And you saw some justices grappling with that. Justice Sotomayor at one point basically accused the plaintiff's lawyer of misrepresenting facts or omitting crucial context. And it led to this very bizarre exchange where he apologized to the court for not having been, in his words, I think, as forthright as the brief ought to have been, which is a very, you don't want to be on your back foot like that in the Supreme Court. You want to make sure your brief is as accurate as possible. So it came up at the argument yesterday, and it may very well appear in the Supreme Court's decision, this question of the deference that the Supreme Court owes to the factual findings.
So could we actually just try to cut to the end for a second? We want to obviously unpack a lot of the specifics in the argument, and you're alluding to some of them here. But we're curious about your view of where this ends up. Where do you think the court's going to land based on what you heard on Monday?
Yeah, so I don't know I don't have a great prediction for how precisely the court will rule, but I think in one form or another, it will be largely, if not entirely, a victory for the Biden administration. There was not a majority of the court, at least at oral argument, that seemed convinced of the core allegations being made by the plaintiffs, that there was a conspiracy between the federal government and the social media platforms to censor speech that the government doesn't like. Justice Kagan at one point said that she didn't think any of the allegations made by the plaintiffs suggested that the platforms were enforcing their policies at the behest of the government as opposed to on the basis of their own editorial decisions to enforce their own content moderation policies. The only justice who seemed potentially convinced of the plaintiff's theory was Justice Alito. Oftentimes Justice, Thomas is in the same boat as Justice Alito, but I don't recall him even really expressing saying that he was convinced or expressing any agreement with the underlying theory. He seemed really focused on a different question. So I think the Biden administration will win. I think there's some question as to how, whether it'll be on the merits, in other words, whether the plaintiffs could show that the government had coerced the platforms, or maybe on some procedural question. The federal government focused a lot on the question of standing. So I don't know which route the court will take, but I think it will very likely be a victory for the Biden administration.
So I definitely want to make sure we talk about the doctrine here, which is kind of a mess, as the justices seem to be struggling with. But before we do, let's jump back briefly to these questions about the factual record. So as you say, there was this kind of incredible moment where Benjamin Aguinaga, the Solicitor General of Louisiana, seemed kind of chastened by Justice Sotomayor saying that she had a problem with his brief. There was also, I thought, a really striking moment where Aguinaga at one point made a reference to material posted by Jim Hoft, who runs the right-wing Gateway Pundit website, as being part of a spreadsheet that was maintained by CISA, the Cybersecurity and Information Security Agency, sort of implying that CISA was using that as, you know, a tracking mechanism to, you know, I think the phrase he used was go after Hoft or take Hoft's post down. And during the rebuttal, Fletcher, who's arguing for the government, actually says, you know, this wasn't maintained. This wasn't a CISA database. This was CISA being aware of notifications to platforms sent by the Stanford Election Integrity Partnership, which was a private organization, not an arm of the government or anything like that, which I think is kind of representative of some of the factual weirdnesses here. There's also some strangenesses, which Justice Kagan seemed really frustrated by in terms of, you know, whose posts were taken down and to what extent that was traceable to government action. Traceability was an issue that came up again and again. So how should we understand the factual weirdnesses here, not only, you know, in and of themselves, but also to what extent should they shape our understandings of the legal issues raised? Like, is this just a weird case? I guess is one way to phrase what I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, it is a weird case. You know, most jawboning cases, you know, cases where a plaintiff says the government violated the First Amendment by pressuring a speech intermediary, like the platforms or, you know, in the days of old, the book distributors, most of them involve pretty discreet conduct, challenged conduct by the government. For example, like the case that was heard right after Murthy, the NRA versus Vulo case, is also a jawboning case. And it centered on a handful of very specific interactions between New York's Department of Financial Services and the NRA's insurance providers. And that's how most jawboning cases arise in the courts. This case is much more atmospheric in nature. You know, it posits a wide conspiracy among the federal agencies to engage in all sorts of disparate conduct, any individual instance of which doesn't really look like jawboning, but collectively make you scratch your heads and wonder, you know, why was the government so invested in responding to all of these different alleged pieces of disinformation on the platforms? I will acknowledge that as a First Amendment advocate, it is a little bit bizarre how invested the federal government was in, you know, responding to all this disinformation. And, you know, we pointed out in the amicus brief that we filed that there was one exchange in particular that seemed to cross the constitutional line, where you had a couple of White House officials berate Facebook for failing to take down, I think it was vaccine hesitancy information, quickly enough. And then when Facebook didn't respond the way they wanted, they said, we're considering our other options. That to me seemed like, you know, crediting the plaintiff's allegations, giving them fair inferences, seemed like a kind of implied threat, and that maybe they should be allowed to go forward on, you know, on that allegation. But the case as a whole is not just about that one instance. It's about this broader pattern of conduct. And again, you know, as Justice Kagan said, it's very hard to connect any of it to any actual instance of suppression that was taken on the basis of government coercion as opposed to the platform's decisions to enforce content moderation policies that they seemingly independently adopted. And that's why so much in the case turns on what you think the right legal standard is. You know, the standard that the lower courts have been operating under since 1963, when the Supreme Court decided the Bantam Books case, is the line between coercion and persuasion. You know, all the lower courts have understood that the First Amendment prohibits the government from coercing intermediaries into suppressing speech, but allows them to persuade. But the plaintiffs in this case have, you know, actually offered a really radically different vision for what the First Amendment prohibits. Their argument really is that the government cannot set about to accomplish the suppression of speech, even if all that it uses is persuasion. It is unconstitutional, the plaintiffs argue, for the federal government to, you know, try to persuade platforms to take down constitutionally protected speech. And, you know, that's why a lot of the questions at argument yesterday were focused on all of the circumstances in which the government historically and up to the present day does that routinely as a matter of course. And, you know, a lot of justices were trying to grapple with what the implications of the plaintiff's very broad legal theory, you know, would be. But if they accept that legal theory, then the plaintiffs probably have a strong case. You know, but to accept that legal theory would be to essentially undo 60 years of legal precedent in the lower court focusing on the line between persuasion and coercion.
So I think Quinta and I have a bunch of questions about this aspect of the doctrine. Quinta's framing a minute ago of it being a weird, strange case, I think is spot on. I also think it's just a weird, hard issue, actually. Like, I think people have a sense here that there is a line where you cross it where the conduct would feel problematic. And then there's also all this benign conduct that I think the justices were referring to repeatedly about kind of educational style communication, letting platforms know about health consequences or emergency situations that I think most people would think is clearly on the right side of the line. And the complexity, which you got into in your excellent brief, is how we draw that line. And I take your point about the value of the Bantam test of coercion versus persuasion, but do you think that's a clear line? Like, does that feel to you like you have a sense just based on those terms of what's on one side and what's on the other?
No, absolutely not. You know, it's a spectrum. It's a spectrum. And that's the challenge with it. These cases are all decided individually on the basis, you know, case by case basis, which is the most frustrating kind of legal test that the law has to offer. But it's hard to imagine a better alternative. You know, if administrability is your biggest concern, a clear rule, if that's your primary concern, then you either have one that is prophylactically protective of free speech rights, which I think the plaintiff's legal test would be, or you have one that is prophylactically unprotective of free speech rights. And nobody was really offering one of those. And, you know, if I think the only benefit that I can see to the plaintiff's theory that the government can't even persuade the suppression of constitutionally protected speech is that it is a clear test, right? That's the advantage of it. But I think it would be a disaster for democracy if that is the test that the Supreme Court endorses, because, you know, one reason why people elect governments, you know, elect officials, is to represent their views in political discourse, to try to persuade the public to care about particular issues, to galvanize public opinion, to steer public attention to issues that the government thinks are important. But all of that could be seen, depending on the context, as efforts by the government to persuade private actors to hold or host different views. And on the plaintiff's theory of the case, all of that would be unconstitutional. And that's, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow in a democracy that relies on, you know, having a government that can govern effectively, because speech is part of governing effectively.
So I thought they were, I didn't hear their theory as quite so broad. I thought they were pretty clear that, like, real sort of informational type communication, like, this is what we're seeing about how COVID misinformation is spreading, would be permissible. I thought they were sort of conceding that. It seemed like on the other end of the spectrum, there was clear acknowledgement of coercion. Like, if you said, we're going to prosecute you unless you remove this content, that seemed like clearly coercive. The thing that is, like, unsettling to me about the test is it just seems like it depends on a level of nuance that's almost impossible to imagine being clear, at least from a platform perspective, I assume from a government perspective as well, in any exchange. Like, some of the hypotheticals were pushing on things like, if you said, this is really problematic for health, and therefore we want you to take it down and take it down now, we will be really concerned if you don't take it down now, that seems to, like, tilt toward some level of threat that might be problematic. It feels like a lot is riding on, like, a couple of additional words that might come at the end of a government communication. And from my sense is, from a platform's perspective, platforms don't need an explicit or implicit threat in a statement to know that there's the possibility that action's going to be taken against them if they don't agree to do what the government does. I don't know. Do you feel like that's an overblown concern?
No, I don't think that's an overblown concern. You need a test that is sensitive enough to recognize threats that are implied. Because, you know, if the doctrine prohibits only explicit threats, then it's basically a roadmap for the government to engage in coercion by another name. And I think that test would not serve First Amendment values well. And, you know, but as soon as you recognize the constitutionally problematic nature of implied threats, you have to figure out how to detect them, you know, how to determine whether something is an implied threat. And that can be especially challenging in the context of a social media platform where, you know, they are repeat players when it comes to interactions with the government. You know, any one interaction between a platform and the government is part of a broader context. And also the platforms are behemoths. It's not like there's a single person that the government is trying, you know, to pressure or persuade, depending on your view, into, you know, taking down particular speech. They might be, in one instance, talking to somebody who feels pretty exposed, you know, who feels as though they don't have the authority to push back in the way that maybe Mark Zuckerberg might have if he were the one in the meeting. And how is the First Amendment meant to deal with those potential asymmetries? And I think the answer is unsatisfying. I think the answer is you have to take all of those contextual clues into account. But I also think there's the possibility of structural protections that might be helpful. So, for example, one thing I find really attractive is a proposal made by the Cato Institute, which we pointed to in our brief, which would require the government to be more transparent about its interactions with the platforms. I think that would do a couple of things. I think it would make it harder for the government to pressure the platforms free from any kind of accountability, whether it's political or judicial, because we would have a better record about what's going on. And I think it would make it easier for the platforms to, you know, push back publicly. I imagine that, you know, one consideration, and maybe I'm curious, Matt, if this was something that occurred to you when, you know, you were on the other side of these exchanges. You know, one thing that is always available to a platform is just to publicize these efforts by the government, you know, to pressure it to take down speech. But I imagine the decision about whether to do so is kind of weighted down by the consideration of how that would affect the platform's relationship, you know, if they published all these emails. And a transparency law would basically take that decision out of the hands of the platforms. They, you know, those exchanges would just become public as a matter of course. And the platforms wouldn't have to decide whether publicizing those efforts would come at a cost, would itself come at a cost, you know, for their relationship with the government, which for understandable reasons they want to preserve.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are exactly the kinds of resolutions, quote unquote, that are helpful to think about. You guys at Knight organized really just an extraordinary convening. I think it was back in October about this issue. And a bunch of people wrote pieces that I think fleshed out various different ways to think about this. I saw in your brief that you cited several of them. Katie Harbath, who used to be at Facebook, and I wrote a piece where we explored a little bit of the transparency type options. Like, we were kind of exploring the idea of some kind of option that allowed platforms to report ex parte communications from government to them. So there are procedures in place for the inverse, for government to report ex parte communications that they get from private entities to try to influence government decision making. And we were exploring the idea of the inverse of government, of platforms reporting government interactions outside of formal democratic channels. And I think that's like a good direction of travel to explore, but the skepticism that you're expressing, I think, is the right one. And I talked about it with some platforms after the fact, and I think they would be hesitant for the reasons that you describe to emphasize the government action, because they would be concerned, I think, about what the implications of that would be for their ongoing relationships with the government. But I do think overall, like, one of the feelings that I had coming out of the yesterday's argument was just that I feel some dissatisfaction of a judicial process rooted in the First Amendment being the way to resolve entirely this issue. And it seems like there should be a First Amendment bar on certain kinds of conduct, and courts should approach that bar with rigor and like close analysis of issues like standing and causation and fealty of the factual record and the things that the justices were pushing on yesterday. And when they do that, it seems to me like it may be that only a small percentage of the things that might want to be concerned about here will be addressed. And so transparency maybe gets at some of that, but my guess is like it wouldn't fully address it either.
I think that's right. And, you know, this is, you know, why we had, you know, the last section of our brief, which actually came up during oral argument. You know, in the last section of our amicus brief, we cautioned the court against trying to use jawboning doctrine, the First Amendment, to solve all of the problems of social media, you know, many of which are, you know, attributable to the concentration of private power over public discourse. And that concentration absolutely exacerbates the problem of job boning because it makes it easier for the government to, you know, have a handful of targets to go after to coerce the suppression of protected speech. But concentration is a much broader problem than just, you know, the First Amendment problem of job boning. And there are solutions, I think, to concentration that would benefit, you know, that would alleviate some of the concerns that you have, Matt, as well as some of the other concerns that, you know, people have with social media. And that would make it unnecessary to try to rely on job boning doctrine as the prophylactic solution for all of these other problems. Because I think that, you know, it would be problematic to distort or stretch job boning doctrine, you know, to meet all of those challenges. Because, you know, the effect would be to disable democratically elected governments from trying to, you know, steer public attention or have important conversations with speech intermediaries. And just to, you know, make clear why I think that matters, it'd be a little bit more concrete, I suppose. There are a lot of private conversations that take place between the government and speakers or the government and hosts for other speech that I think most people would recognize are socially beneficial and don't really raise any significant First Amendment problem. The example that we gave in our brief was an exchange that took place between the Bush administration and the New York Times. When the New York Times, you know, two New York Times reporters had learned of the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program and they were going to publish and they called, you know, they went to the Bush administration for a reaction. And the Bush administration, you know, spent a lot of time trying to convince the Times that publishing that story would endanger intelligence gathering by the Bush administration. It would make it harder for them to spy on Al-Qaeda terrorists. And the New York Times held on to the story for a year. I think that was too long. I don't think they should have held on to it for that long. But they held on to it for a year because they were convinced, you know, and the Bush administration had something to offer in that conversation that the Times couldn't have gotten on its own, which was a perspective on how revealing the warrantless wiretapping program might implicate national security. Now, the response that the plaintiff's lawyer gave during oral argument to that, not that specific hypo, but hypos like that, was to basically say, well, terrorist speech is not protected or national security can always be enforced. It always satisfies strict scrutiny. But I don't think that's right. I think in the New York Times example, it was clearly constitutional or, you know, protected against criminal law enforcement for the New York Times to publish that story. There was nothing the government could have done to prevent the New York Times from publishing that story, right? We have the Pentagon Papers case from the 70s that said a prior restraint in that context would have been unconstitutional. And there's no broad category of terrorist speech that is unprotected by the First Amendment. And so I don't think some broad national security interest solves the plaintiff's problem in all of those hypotheticals. I think their theory really would have made it very difficult for the government to engage in all these kinds of, again, what most people probably would agree are socially beneficial exchanges between the government and private speech intermediaries.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I will say I was really struck by that exchange over terrorist speech because actually pretty closely analogous conversation happened during the NetChoice arguments over these restrictive Texas and Florida laws that restrict platforms' ability to moderate content, where I believe it was the Texas Solicitor General made a similar argument at one point of, you know, oh, well, it would be fine if platforms took down terrorist speech under our law because we have a carve out for illegal content. And one of the justices
it may have been, I think it was Justice Kagan or Kavanaugh, it was Kagan in this instance in the Murthy argument sort of said, you know, there's plenty of terrorist speech that's protected by the First Amendment. And I do think that that sort of eliding that complication, the fact that the states, Texas in that instance, Louisiana and Missouri in this instance, the fact that they keep kind of sliding past it is really representative of this sort of effort to ignore how complicated this can be. I mean, to your point about the you know, potentially really important role of government interactions, I think one thing that was touched on briefly in this argument by the Solicitor General's office, but deserves more attention, is how this case has really led the federal government to pull back from partnerships with tech companies before the 2024 election in ways that I find really concerning. And this is even after the injunction had been stayed by the Supreme Court. I did a piece for Lawfare with Eugenia Lustre on how many efforts from CISA, from the FBI, have basically just stopped in terms of communications with tech companies. Facebook had a report in November that said, we have heard absolutely nothing from the federal government in terms of foreign election interference communications since July. And the question of First Amendment implications of sort of coordination in private are complicated, as we're talking about here. But I do think it seems pretty clear to me that existing in this situation where nobody knows what the rules are and the federal government is therefore scared to do anything is really bad, especially heading into an election where it seems, I think, fair to say we're expecting a certain amount of foreign interference and also, you know, the potential for real political violence like that. That seems not great to me.
I think that, you know, these cases have also kind of cast a pall over independent research that is really important for understanding all of those potential threats to our elections, to our, you know, public discourse. And, you know, independent research, private research, you know, done by academic researchers, done by journalists, is absolutely constitutionally protected. You know, even if it results in the suppression of speech on the platforms, it's constitutionally protected. And, you know, it also helps us understand our digital environment. But, you know, often that research, you know, those researchers rely on partnerships with the federal government, or they rely on funding from the federal government, at least in part, or they rely on the willingness of the platforms to talk to them. And, you know, the Murthy litigation and then a whole bunch of other lawsuits filed against the researchers have chilled some of that research. They've, you know, made it harder for the researchers to do their work. And I'm worried, you know, kind of echoing what you just said, Quinta, that we're heading into this election season with our heads in the sand because, you know, we don't have the censors, you know, S-E-N, not C-E-N, censors. You know, we don't have the researchers to help us understand what's going to take place during these elections and whether Russian interference is going to meaningfully impact political ads or political conversations on the platforms, whether misinformation about the time and place and location, you know, time and place of elections, you know, is going to affect people's ability to exercise their right to vote. And I really, you know, worry about that a lot too.
Yoel Roth wrote a great piece as part of the symposium about some of the nature of their interactions with between Twitter and the FBI specifically, and how benign and helpful they are in most cases. And that's consistent with my experience at Facebook. My sense is like a lot of those interactions are sort of low intensity, high value, very like informal and collaborative in a way that I think is like very productive. So I share your concern. So going forward, like, you know, we should have an opinion here at some point before the end of June. So we will, it may be part of the election season, we won't have guidance on this, but then presumably like for the summer and fall, we will. Do you anticipate, given the direction that you think the court's going in, do you anticipate, a ruling that is favorable for the Biden administration? How will that alter practice going into the election? Like, do you think we will kind of, we will be where we are now with government agencies being hesitant to communicate with social media platforms, or do you think we'd see some of that communication come back?
That's a really great question. And I think it might depend on the way the court rules. If, you know, if the court gets rid of the case on some procedural ground without clarifying what the constitutional limits are on government conversations with the platforms, then maybe not. Maybe we won't see the government resume these conversations because they'll continue to be worried about how the Supreme Court would view their constitutionality. And, you know, maybe that's an especially good argument for the court to dive into the doctrine and clarify what, you know, what the test is. And, you know, even if that's as simple as reaffirming the line from Bantam Books, which again was that 1963 case, even if it's just reaffirming that Bantam Books provides the right line, I think that would be valuable. But I think it'd be valuable for the court to go a little bit further than that, just because, you know, as Matt, as you've pointed out, Bantam, you know, is not the clearest of tests. It has not been applied in the clearest fashion in the lower courts. And there's actually a lot of confusion in the lower courts. You know, I said that most courts have understood that to be the line, or courts have understood that to be the line, but there's a competing line that a handful of other courts have relied on that is different from Bantam. And to my mind, it's really perplexing why they rely on this other line of cases where you have a direct one from the Supreme Court in Bantam Books that sets out what I think is the constitutional line. So I think that clarity would be helpful. And if the court provides it, then maybe that would be a basis on which the federal government could, you know, probably the SG's office or the AG could tell the agencies, you know, could give them guidance on how to resume those conversations without running into the risk of violating the First Amendment.
Yeah, so let's talk about the doctrine a little bit more and Bantam Books and this kind of competing way of viewing these issues. So you wrote in your amicus brief that the relevant First Amendment doctrine is in disarray, which I think is an accurate and depressing way of characterizing just the total confusion that everyone seemed to be grappling with here. So maybe can you spell it in a little more detail what exactly the Bantam Books line of cases is here, and then what this competing argument about state action is in this other case, Bloom v. Uretsky?
Yeah. So, you know, Bantam was a classic jawboning case. You know, it was a First Amendment case where book distributors sued the Rhode Island Commission on Morality and Youth, arguing that this commission had violated the First Amendment by threatening book distributors for liability for carrying books that the commission said were objectionable. Not because they were necessarily obscene, which is what the law, you know, actually forbade them from selling, but objectionable in some way. And the result was what the Supreme Court called this informal system of censorship, you know, in which the commission was able to carry out its censorial aims without all the constitutional protections that would normally apply to the sale of books. And what the court said that what was problematic about this system was that it was coercive. And following that ruling, lower courts, you know, drew a distinction between coercion on the one hand, which the court said was unconstitutional, and persuasion, where the government is offering either good faith advice to private actors on what their legal obligations are, or just trying to persuade them to share the government's views. So that, you know, that's the line that most courts, or that's the test that most courts have applied. But there are a handful of courts that apply the test from Blum versus Uretsky, which is not a First Amendment case. It's a, you know, it's a state action case. It's a case about when either the government is responsible for the conduct of private actors, or when you can actually sue the private actors themselves as though they were the government. And the facts of the case are, you know, they're not all that relevant, but just, you know, just to prove the point that it wasn't a First Amendment case, it had to do with private nursing homes that had discharged patients without what the plaintiffs claimed were the constitutionally required procedures for discharging patients. And the plaintiffs basically claimed that the private nursing homes were entangled sufficiently with the government that they, you know, that the government could be held liable to the Fifth Amendment's requirement of due process for the private nursing homes decision. So again, it was not a First Amendment case. It was a state action case. And the test that the court set out in that case was a really stringent one. It said you can hold the government liable for the conduct of private actors when the government has so significantly coerced or encouraged the private conduct that, and this is a rough quote, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but so that the choice in law made by the private actor must be deemed to be that of the state. And it's a very high standard, deliberately so, because a consequence of a finding of state action is that private actors can be held to constitutional standards, which is a significant thing. It's a significant thing to override a private individual's right to behave the way they want and to say that they are actually bound by the Constitution. And it's especially significant in the First Amendment context, you know, because one consequence of a finding, for example, that Facebook was a state actor in its exchanges with the government and in its decisions to take down certain speech, is that Facebook can be held to First Amendment standards, which implicates Facebook's own First Amendment right to adopt content moderation policies of its own choosing. And it implicates the First Amendment right of Facebook users to have a community that is policed according to those private editorial decisions rather than the First Amendment standards, which would require Facebook to allow all sorts of speech that, you know, Facebook's users might not want to interact with on the platform. So those are the two kind of competing lines of precedent that the courts have relied on. And, you know, I think I've kind of foregrounded why I think the Blum test is not the right one. I think the Bantam test is the right one. You know, it might be that in some cases, so let me just explain why I think there is confusion. It's because both cases use the language of coercion. And, you know, Bantam says coercion, interpreted by lower courts to be coercion versus persuasion. Blum says coercion, you know, such significant coercion that the choice in law must be deemed to be that of the state. I think it's basically coercion plus. It's, you know, extremely significant coercion. And I think that matters because the state action test is trying to answer a very different question than the First Amendment test is trying to answer. And, you know, there's a risk in applying that test in jawboning cases. Now, it may be that there is a subset of jawboning cases where the plaintiff could demonstrate not just the lower level of coercion required to make out a First Amendment violation, but the higher level of coercion so that you can hold the government accountable for the private actor's decisions and also even hold the private actor to constitutional standards. It may be there's a subset of those cases, you know, that reach that level. And maybe even a subset of those cases where it would be constitutionally tolerable for a court to impose a remedy against the private actor that would require them to do something that the First Amendment normally forbids courts from requiring private actors to do, which is to host speech they don't want to host. But those are going to be, I think, extremely rare, that, you know, that category of cases. And, you know, if and when a court finds that that's appropriate, it will need to grapple with the First Amendment implications of issuing a remedy against a private actor like that, which I think would be significant. I can imagine circumstances where it would be appropriate, but they are not the mine run of jawboning cases, which I think, again, should be resolved under the First Amendment case, you know, Bantam Books. I hope that was not too confusing, but yeah.
If it was confusing, I think it's confusing because the doctrine is confusing, right? I mean, so the Fifth Circuit seemed persuaded by this argument about Blum and state action. The court, it seemed to me, was really not so interested in this line of argument, and it seemed relatively clear that they were, to the extent that what's going on in this case is a choice between Bantam Books and Blum, that they were going to go with Bantam Books. Does that seem fair?
I think so. I didn't really try to count the votes on that particular question, but, you know, it was interesting to me that Brian Fletcher, who was representing the SG's office, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but I think he said that the tests are really doing very similar work in this context. And you know, maybe that's right if you understand Blum just to work very differently in the First Amendment context. But I do worry a little bit because I think what motivated the Fifth Circuit was that it didn't think Bantam was broad enough to encompass unconstitutional efforts by the government, not to coerce, but to induce platforms into censoring constitutionally protected speech. And so instead, what the court did was to basically dilute, you know, to water down the test from Blum to reach encouragement, which is what the word the Fifth Circuit used. And that word was used in Blum, but it was also surrounded by a bunch of other limiting words in Blum. Again, such substantial encouragement that the choice in law must be deemed to be that of the state, which is a very specific, you know, that's a very high form, you know, demanding test, you know, to satisfy. And I think there's a risk in watering down the test for state action because normally, again, speech intermediaries like Facebook should not be subject to First Amendment limitations in the way that they moderate speech on their platform. To the contrary, they're protected by the First Amendment, you know, in their content moderation decisions. So I think there's a danger in conceptually thinking of state action as being the right test in all but a very, very narrow set of cases that, you know, is probably vanishingly small.
So I'm curious about your take on the politics here. like, it seems like this has a particular valence because the issue was the Biden administration putting pressure on tech companies related to information that I think many people on the left think tech companies should do a better job of moderating. So I was struck by some of the headlines yesterday, like in anticipation of the argument, NPR's headline was "Supreme Court examines whether government can combat disinformation online." And when I was listening to the PBS live stream of it, the PBS heading for it was "Supreme Court hears case on collaboration between government and social media companies." And I think the framing, if the issue were coming from, for example, the Trump administration on content moderation approaches that are more supported by the right and disfavored by the left, those headlines would be very different. And one question I had here is whether people who might have concern about the kinds of pressures that a Trump administration would impose on social media companies would actually want a strong rule in this case, not to constrain the Biden administration, but to constrain a potential Trump administration or future administrations who might have a broad view of how aggressive they can be with respect to social media companies. I'm curious how you see that playing out. Let's say that Trump is elected in November. Is this issue going to take on kind of a different resonance with some of the communities that have been supportive of one point of view to date?
It's a great question. I think it might, which is why I think we really need a rule that everybody would be satisfied with, no matter which political party happens to be in power. And even in this case, some of the plaintiff's allegations date back to the Trump administration. They are about efforts by the Trump administration to, you know, police disinformation about, you know, COVID-19. I think the 2020 election stuff, I think for the most part, took place after, you know, the end of the Trump administration. But, you know, you want a rule that satisfies everybody. And that means it needs to apply in a way that draws a line that is defensible no matter the politics. And, you know, I will say, you know, there's a lot of concern in the free speech community that given the partisan valence of these cases, and not just these cases, you know, but the NetChoice cases and also the Gonzalez and Tomna cases last term, that given the partisan valence of these cases, they were worried about rulings from the Supreme Court that reflected that tenor. And for that reason, kind of parted way with the First Amendment principles, their free speech principles. And I have been encouraged by the way, at least by the oral arguments in the NetChoice cases and in Murthy and Vulo, the NRA case, and also by the decision in the Gonzalez case, where the court basically punted on the Section 230 question. I've been encouraged by the care with which the Supreme Court seems to be going about it, the business of figuring out what the right rules are to determine whether the government has crossed the First Amendment line. They seem really attentive to the interests on both, you know, on both sides of, you know, the First Amendment equation.
So I would love to think there's some chance here of a satisfying rule, but I kind of thought, maybe I'm hearing it wrong, but I thought the theme of this conversation was basically the Supreme Court might reach the right outcome and it will probably be dissatisfying in some ways to everyone, as opposed to the inverse of like, they'll find their way to a rule that will like govern every case effectively. Do you think it's possible that there's going to be a rule that would like, you know, work in a range of circumstances, not just governing the Biden administration, but governing the Trump administration as well? Cause like my feeling coming out of this is like in hearing the argument and the, like necessary and important discipline of the justices was that the law is designed to resolve cases narrowly. And that's a good thing. We should want that. We should invite it. But
yeah.
This is an issue that's broader than any one particular case. And there might be a lot of things that we want the government not to do, kind of independent of whether there's actually a First Amendment violation that could be held up in court.
Well, so I think there are really two questions bound up there. I think what we want is a rule that is apolitical. You know, we want a rule that either equally satisfies or equally dissatisfies everybody. But then there's a separate question of, you know, can we actually fashion a rule that protects the First Amendment values we want to protect. And this goes back to where, you know, I think we kind of started, which is that it's very hard to come up, you know, even accepting that the line between persuasion and coercion is the right one, which is what I think, even accepting that, it's very hard to draw that line. It's going to be case by case. And I just don't think there's a reasonable alternative on the table to case by case adjudication of these kinds of claims. And I would love it if we had a clearer rule. There are a lot of context in the law where I would love it if we had a clearer rule because it would be more predictable for everybody involved. I just worry that the only way to clarify this line is, again, either to be prophylactically protective of the speech rights of platforms and users at the expense of the ability of governments to govern, which, you know, some people frame that as being about government speech, which I think is the wrong way to frame it, because, you know, I don't really think the government has a speech right. I think the public has an interest in having a government that can be effective, which is something that I think actually Brian Fletcher did a really nice job of explaining this in the argument yesterday, that that is a kind of structural necessity that emerges from the Constitution. You need a government that can govern. That involves speaking, and it involves taking advantage of the bully pulpit to try to convince people. You know, or you have a rule, again, that is prophylactically unprotective of speech rights, which I think would be problematic for the other reason, which is that it would give the government way too much power to shape public discourse, to distort it to, you know, political or partisan ends, and allow the government to set orthodoxy in our political discourse. And I think it's worth giving up the administrability that would come with either one of those prophylactic rules for the more intellectually coherent but fuzzier rule that is somewhere in the middle. And I, you know, I share your concerns, Matt, that it's a fuzzy rule. I just don't know what the alternative is.
So we've mentioned the net choice cases a few times, and I did want to kind of circle back to them at the close here and ask, now that we've heard the Supreme Court have oral arguments in both the net choice cases and Murthy, if there's any connections you see between this sort of group of First Amendment internet law adjacent litigation that's been before the court, is there anything that we can say about how the justices seem to be thinking about these issues, or anything that's revealed by kind of looking at these cases alongside one another?
Yeah, I mean, I think thematically, to my mind, the most important connection is that both cases are about the extent to which the government can regulate social media. In net choice, it's about direct regulation, and in the jawboning cases, it's about indirect regulation through either threats or pressure or cajoling, what have you, browbeating, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, there's another connection that some people pointed to after the argument yesterday, which is that some of the questions yesterday seemed to take for granted that the platforms had First Amendment rights, which is, of course, one of the very questions at issue in the net choice case, because Texas and Florida in those cases argue that they can regulate the content moderation decisions of the platforms or require them to carry speech they don't want to carry, or, to take another framing, forbid them from discriminating against the speech of their users, because the platforms themselves don't have any free speech rights, because they are just, you know, either common carriers that can be regulated or neutral conduits for the speech of others. And, you know, I'm a little bit less convinced that the court in ruling in the Murthy case has to, you know, accept that premise. But I think it's a good sign if they do, because I think the platforms do have free speech rights, and their free speech rights are intimately connected with the free speech rights of their users, who I think benefit from having platforms that can construct communities that are responsive to the needs and desires and wants of the platform's users.
Let's leave it there. Alex, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Arbiters of Truth, a Lawfare podcast series on the information ecosystem. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare podcast feed. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. The podcast is edited by Jen Paccia, and your audio engineer this episode was Noah Mosband of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.